Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there, welcome along to another classic replay deep from the archives of Unbelievable, this one from 2013. Former atheist Holly Ordway came to Christian faith via poetry and literature, and she tells her story and explains her passion for literary apologetics in today's show. Laura Miller is an online literary critic and an agnostic. She loved the Narnia stories as a child, but felt betrayed by C.S. Lewis after discovering their Christian symbolism as an adult. Well, in this show, Holly and Laura discuss the rights and wrongs of using literature for a Christian message. Do great art, poetry, and literature point to a transcendent reality? That was our other question. Hope you enjoyed today's show. And don't forget, if you want more from C.S. Lewis, do check out our C.S. Lewis podcast over at premierunbelievable.com. So many great episodes of the show there, especially, of course, Alistair McGrath, the key guest from week to week on the show, bringing you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with the presenter Ruth Jackson. Again, that's premierunbelievable.com. And when you register there at our website, you'll get loads of great access to all of the material across our website. But for now, let's join Laura Miller and Holly Ordway in today's classic replay, first broadcast in 2013. Well, it's my great pleasure to be joined in the studio by Holly Ordway, who's a poet, a Christian apologist, and chair of the Department of Apologetics at Houston Baptist University. She has a story of actually being converted from atheism as an adult to Christianity via literature and poetry. It's in her book, Not God's Type. And you can find out more about her at her website, hieropraxis.com. Laura Miller is my other guest, joining us by phone from the States, also an American. She joined me on the programme actually a few years ago, and if you go back in the archives, you'll find a really interesting discussion between her and C.S. Lewis scholar Michael Ward when she came on to talk about her book, The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Well, Laura's an atheist, a writer and book reviewer for Salon.com, and she's going to be interacting with Holly on this question of using literature to promote or not other worldviews. Thank you both for being with me on the programme today. And before we come to Laura, let's introduce Holly, who's new to the programme. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, I'm just delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Holly, your name's come up before. I've certainly wanted to have you on the show for a while. So I was so pleased when I heard you were going to be over in England, spending some time, I think, in Oxford is where you're based, just for part of the summer. But let's go back to the beginning for those who have no idea who you are, because you've got a really interesting story of becoming a Christian, not necessarily by a very conventional route. It was really through engaging with literature, which has been a passion pretty much your whole life, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And the interesting thing is, and this is something I wrote about in my book, Not God's Type, that when it came down to a certain point in my life, apologetic arguments were very important, actually looking at the rational basis, the arguments for the existence of God, for the resurrection. But the question that has been sticking with me over the past couple of years since I wrote that book has been, what got me to the point that I was interested in these questions, and how did that make a difference? And what I realized is that it was my engagement with literature all through my life. Imagination has been just so important to me. As a voracious reader, I read everything I get my hands on. Love fantasy, love folk tales. When I got into college, loved poetry. And then it ended up being when I was 31 that it was encountering, re-encountering actually, poets that I had learned about as an undergraduate and glimpsing the Christian worldview through their poetry, especially John Donne, his holy sonnet that starts out, "Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend," and goes on from there. And I thought, wow, there's something happening here that I don't understand. It's like it's tapping into something powerful that, in retrospect, I think it was finally connecting to my imagination that had been sort of all along kind of bubbling beneath the surface. And that was what prompted me to start investigating Christianity. And then actually C.S. Lewis in particular played an important role in the last sort of the last stage of it. Cause I like C.S. Lewis, as discovered later, I had a two-step conversion, was converted first to theism and then separately in a sense to Christianity. And Lewis was really important with that second step.
And in a sense, you seem to share a lot in common with him in terms of the passion for literature. He obviously was a voracious reader, a writer himself, loved poetry as well, though I don't think he ever quite scaled the heights he hoped to on that front. But he you get this sense, especially reading things like his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that seeing something transcendent in the literature he was engaged with started that journey for him towards opening him up to theism and eventually to Christianity.
I think yes, but I think it's a little bit more complex than that as well, because I think that what he felt was a vast sense of longing, what he calls joy in his autobiography. And he was looking for something that would satisfy that and failing to find it in everything that he tried, and eventually concluding at a certain point that rationally speaking, he didn't think that anything could satisfy it, and yet imaginatively he still had this longing. And so then eventually he realized that philosophically and rationally theism made sense, and so he got part of the way there, and so he was a theist, but what was missing was still the imaginative connection. And I think what drew him in the end was that he realized, not that he was looking for God, not at all, I don't think. And rather, it was that what he was looking for turned out to be found in God, which surprised and I think a little horrified him. And I think those are not exactly the same things.
Yes, and he describes himself, of course, as the most reluctant convert in all England, you know, in that section of his autobiography. And of course, when it came to that step to Christianity, it was another famous literary figure, J.R.R. Tolkien, his good friend in Oxford, who was part of that journey himself, to sort of bring him into that last aspect of understanding. I mean, when it comes to the Narnia stories, which is, of course, what C.S. Lewis remains best known for, and what obviously Laura will be talking about as well as she joins us, the fact is many people, when engaging as children with the stories, don't realise that there is this Christian subtext.
I didn't.
Right. And so, exactly. And at what point did you realise? Was it as an adult, looking back a bit, you started to realise, OK, yeah, there are some obvious parallels here?
It was actually quite a bit later, and that's why, Laura, I was quite intrigued by you having similar experience, because our experiences tracked quite well, I think. I first encountered the Chronicles of Narnia, I think, when I was about 6 or 7. I don't even remember. I just remember that I read them in the proper order.
That's a bit of a bone of contention itself, isn't it?
yes, I was delighted to see that you had the proper order listed in there. Hooray. So I read them. I loved them. Just was imaginatively nourished by them. But I was raised in a completely non-Christian family. Not hostile, but not Christian at all. So all of the Christian elements were completely just absent for me. And I engaged with them as the imaginative richness was there. And actually, I think that Michael Ward's done a lot of great work in helping to explain and unpack why the stories have the effect that they do, even if you don't get any of the direct symbolism or the direct connections. So I loved them as a as a little kid, loved them even, I think, into my teens. Because I had no exposure to Christianity. I didn't know. I thought it was a little surreal that there was a lamb with fish at the end of the Dawn Treader, but I thought, well, this is a fantasy world. That's okay. And it was really not, I think, and I don't quite remember when, it was in, I think, my 20s that I finally, you know, cottoned on. And I was really ticked off. Because at that point, I had become, I'd consciously become an atheist because I thought this, you know, Christianity doesn't make any sense. I, you know, it's superstition. I don't need any of that. And I actually felt, I think your word is a good word, Laura, at first a little betrayed. How dare he smuggle in this Christian stuff into these stories? And I was really angry. And then I ended up, I wrote my dissertation on fantasy literature. And so I worked a great deal with Tolkien and with Lewis. And interestingly, it was in writing that chapter on religious fantasy and writing about Lewis's use of the Chronicles to, you know, convey Christian ideas. That actually was what reconciled me to the way that he had used Christianity in them. Because what I realized when I actually went back and looked at the stories is that he isn't actually shoving Christianity in my face, because everything in the story works perfectly and beautifully as a story. And there's another level that's there if you want to engage with it.
Mm. And well, I was going to say, this is where we should probably bring Laura in, because this is very much touching on the issues that she raises in her book, The Magician's Book. Laura, thank you for joining me on the program today. Really pleased to have you in this conversation. Just for those who perhaps haven't heard the program of a few years ago we did with you, do you want to just briefly fill us in on your background and what you do and where Narnia came in as a child for you and this reaction you had once you did find out the sort of Christian symbolism?
Sure. Well, the book that I wrote, The Magician's Book, is sort of the story of my experience, and it's woven in with some literary criticism and some biographical stuff about C.S. Lewis and a little bit of Tolkien in there as well. But simply put, I was given the books when I was about 7, I was in the second grade, by a favorite teacher, and I completely loved them. They were my favorite books through my whole childhood. And then when I was in my early teens, I became very interested in fantasy, children's fantasy, and that was almost all that I read. It definitely was my favorite type of book. I was pursuing it, trying to sort of follow it into the different adult forms that were out there and trying to find more books, and I read a history of fantasy literature, one of the very early ones, because this was back in the 70s, and that was how I was informed that there was of the Christian subtext or symbology in the Chronicles, and I became very upset, and I felt betrayed, as Holly put it. I was raised in a Christian household. I was raised as a Catholic. We were sort of in a liberal Catholic church, so it was not super gothic or anything like that. But I was I had my first communion, and I was confirmed probably around the same time that I found out about the Christian aspect of Narnia. So I went pretty far along in Christian education, and yet, you know, I somebody had to point out that aspect of the Chronicles to me. I didn't even really realize that. I think that there's a way that a child experiences a story that is really different from the way that an adult does. The idea of there being simultaneous layers of meaning in it is much more of an adult concept. And that's why, in my experience, having written this book about Narnia and as a result talked to a lot of people about Narnia and their experiences reading it as a child, almost nobody, unless they are told in advance as a child reading those books, realizes that they have this other meaning.
Hmm. So having had this sort of a bit of a letdown as far as the books were concerned and feeling a bit betrayed and whatnot. Did that kind of put you off the idea generally of what might be seen as smuggling Christian ideas into literature? Do you think that's a bit underhand, especially perhaps when it comes to children's literature, where, if you like, there's less of an ability to critically engage Christian ideas and so on?
It's hard to describe, because I think that specifically I had come to not be very happy with my experience of Christianity, or with Christianity as I knew it. And that made me unhappy with C.S. Lewis and the Narnia books. But I don't know that I necessarily was ever very pleased about children's literature that was trying to instruct me. My mother and my grandmother had given me this book. Probably, it seems that nobody else has ever heard of it, but my grandmother liked it as a child, called Elsie Dinsmore. And she was a very, very virtuous child who had all of these sort of adventures with her family. They weren't even really adventures. It was just a very boring sort of domestic novel in which she exhibited her Christian virtues at every opportunity in the most priggish and annoying way, and I loathed her. I don't know why I finished the book, but I probably was just desperate for reading material. But that, to me, represented the sort of morally,
sanctimonious kind of, literature.
Yeah. And it's not that I ever thought that Narnia was like that. I mean, looking back, obviously, it's silly to feel betrayed by something having more than one meaning, but I think that it was more that what Narnia meant to me personally was not compatible with this idea. And so I felt that I had been thrown out of this really sort of cherished relationship.
Sure.
Because it was not compatible with the idea that it was giving me religious instruction.
Well, it's interesting because in a way, I would kind of push back a little bit, and I would say that the fact that you didn't notice that it was Christian until it was pointed out to you almost kind of cuts against the idea that it was giving religious instruction. And I think, for me, looking at literature that I think is effective as literature and literature that's not, I think the element of didacticism is genuinely really annoying. I think
the Elsie Ginsmore or whoever it is.
Yeah, and I think that sort of Elsie factor is not limited to Christianity, although it's often very obtrusive. There's a lot of really hideously awful Christian literature, and I will be the first to say it and have said it publicly in many occasions. But you also get, for instance, Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, which is imaginatively very rich, it's very well written, and it veers off towards the end into pure rant. It's sanctimonious atheism, which I think spoils the books. And I think you get that with, for instance, modern-day realistic so-called problem novels, where the virtues are things like do it your own way and, stand up for what you believe in, whatever that might be. I think there's a whole set of modern secular humanist virtues that modern secular humanist writers can be awfully sanctimonious about. So I think that element is what I think is genuinely objectionable. But I actually would say that's precisely what we don't have in the Chronicles of Narnia or something like The Lord of the Rings. And I think we can tell that it's not there because, I mean, as a child, you were able to see in Elsie Dinsmore, it was overt. That says that it was there in a way that I would say maybe wasn't in Lewis.
Yeah, no, I would not argue with you on that, Holly. I don't think that that the Narnia books, for the most part, have anything particularly pedantic about them or convey, this sort of luxury thing that I subjected to in Elsie Dinsmore. I think that as I said, it was more that I had a particular relationship with Narnia personally that I felt had been sort of overthrown by this revelation that was not compatible with this revelation, because I think that I wanted to believe that the story just that what was on the top level of the story was the most important thing. And part of what I write about in my book is there's often this idea that people have when they're talking about the Chronicles that they are deceptive. I don't agree with that anymore. That's how I felt about it before. That children are stupid or just naive, let's say, and they don't get it, and that once you're an adult and you realize that they have this, quote, agenda, unquote, you know what's really going on with the stories. And part of the point of my book is that it isn't necessarily true that the layer of meaning that's a little bit deeper that you don't get, or the layer of meaning that's less overt, let me say, that you don't get when you're a child is any less important than the layer of meaning that you reach just on the level of the story that is what you respond to as a child. That none of those different levels of meaning is more important than any other.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you on that. And actually, I think that's one of the reasons why the current state of literature written by Christians is so ghastly, because I think you get folks who very well intentioned, but I want to whack them upside the head, in a gracious,
in a Christian way,
because they think that they have a good intention and a good moral, and they think that therefore they will write a book that is only on the overt level. And I mean, Lewis himself is very clear about this. He talks in his essay on I think it's on stories. I could be getting that wrong. He talks, or maybe it's sometimes fairy stories may say best what's to be said. Anyway, he says that there are two voices that have to be considered when you're thinking about a story, and one's the author's voice, which is the voice of creativity, of story, of invention, and then there's the man's voice, which is the voice of sort of value, and the author's voice says, "I have a great story, I want to tell it," and the man's voice says, "But is it a story that's worth telling? Is this a good story?" And he says that if you have only the man's voice, only the values, the story can't be told because it won't be a story. And if you have only the author's voice with total disregard for values, it shouldn't be told. Now, he's making a case for bringing them together. Mm-hmm. Now, sadly, I think he was partly wrong, because I think you actually can tell a story with just the man's voice, which is just the values. It's really a bad story. And we get too much of that. And you get people trying to read stories just that way.
Yeah. I mean, coming to this issue of, you've said straight up there's a lot of bad Christian literature out there. I mean, I discovered in a Christian bookstore when I visited America a kind of retelling of the Narnia story. I won't name names or publishers or anything, but it was basically turning what was already a children's book into a real children's book, if you know what I mean. Simplified the language, took one strand of the story. It was Edmund's sort of struggle with the White Witch, kind of basically made it a lot more blatantly Christian. And I just thought to myself, would Lewis be turning in his grave seeing that done to his book? Because he obviously had a very specific purpose in mind, it would appear, of not just making it a Christian book in that sense, as you've mentioned. We're going to sort of open this out a bit, I think. It would be fun to talk about generally literature, just aside from just Narnia. But a quote that always strikes me as interesting from Lewis, I think it comes from Surprised by Joy, where he says, "A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. There are traps everywhere." I don't know whether for you, Laura, anything you've ever read makes you think, well, I don't believe in God, but I feel like it would be nice if there were a God, because this makes sense of this literature or this feeling, this transcendent thing that I seem to be encountering. This was certainly appears to be part of Holly's journey. I don't know if you can relate on that to that at any level yourself.
Well, it's difficult to say, because it's always difficult in talking with believers, because for the believer, there's a reality that that they live in that I am sort of unaware of or sort of operating on a another plane. And if I'm lucky, you know, I could fall through that hole and be in the reality that they live in. Whereas, you know, I just don't experience it that way. And so I don't think I ever really feel in danger of, you know, accidentally believing or, it's hard to describe, or sort of stumbling into it. I mean, my interpretation of Lewis's path, as I perceive it, having read a lot of this stuff, is that he found himself really wanting to believe. He found himself basically a sort of larval believer, and then he was able to find the pathway to that through sort of a different, you know, artistic or intellectual or philosophical paths towards this thing that he wanted. What Holly was talking about before, I just haven't really felt that desire, and so and it's kind of impossible to accidentally or sort of inadvertently come into a state of a desire to believe. So no, I mean, I've read works of literature that have emerged from all different kinds of faith without feeling.
And when you read that thing that makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, you don't think, do you just say, well, that's just the way I'm responding? It doesn't make you think, is this talking about something beyond just itself?
Well, it's you know, every piece of a culture is part of something greater, because a culture and then all of the creative works of humanity are also a larger thing. So, you know, I mean, I know the experience you're talking about, definitely. I just don't interpret it as a religious experience or as a proto-religious experience. I don't experience it as something small or limited just because it's not religious.
Well, that's interesting, because I think this whole idea of a desire to believe, I don't think that's what Lewis is talking about, and that wasn't at all my experience. For instance, insofar as I had any desire related to religion, it was in fact a desire to stick to my atheism, because I thought it was what I believed to be true. I didn't want to become a Christian. I mean, there also is a practical reason why I didn't want to become a Christian too. I thought it would be embarrassing. I think for myself, and I think also as I read Lewis, I don't at all see it as a desire to believe in God. I find it's a desire to grasp that transcendent reality that is just outside of the grasp of the present moment, and what that is isn't labeled as this is belief in God. And actually, I think I would say that if I wanted to believe, that would undercut any possibility of me believing, because then it just becomes me trying to convince myself of something. It's a desire to encounter. And that's what literature sort of did for me, was to orient me towards this thing that, whatever it was actually much bigger than I thought.
We're going to have to take a quick break, folks. Fascinating conversation so far. My guests today are Holly Ordway, who's a poet, a Christian apologist from the States. Her book, Not God's Type, tells of her journey from atheism to Christianity via literature. And that's the subject today as we continue the discussion with Laura Miller, who is the author of The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Come back again in a short moment's time. This is Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking. My guests today are Holly Ordway, who's a poet, Christian apologist, and chair of the Department of Apologetics at Houston Baptist University. But spending a little time over in England this summer, she was available to come into our studio here in London and has been talking to us about her journey to faith via literature, via apologetics. Hieropraxis.com, if you want to find out more about her, where she blogs regularly. And if you can't spell that... well, that's just Holly, you know, made a very bad choice a few years ago about what to call her blog. But what does chiropraxis actually mean?
It is a made-up word. I did a very Humpty Dumpty thing and invented a portmanteau word. I do not know Greek, but I took two Greek roots. I took hiero, which means holy. That's where we get hieroglyphics, holy writing of the Egyptians, mm-hmm. and praxis, which means practice or living out. It's a place where I and some other writers who write for me sort of explore what it means to live out the Christian life with all of its complexity. And you can also go to hollyordway.com and it'll redirect you.
That's the easy version.
Yeah.
So anyway, also Laura Miller with us on the line, a writer and book reviewer for Salon.com, which she helped to found, and author of the Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. She came on a few years ago, actually, to talk to us about this with Michael Ward, who I think is a colleague of yours, isn't he?
He is now, yes.
At Houston Baptist University. But relates in the book this idea of kind of being disappointed, a bit betrayed at the idea that Lewis had sort of smuggled in this Christian imagery, which she just hadn't realised until later on. I mean, we've talked about that, Laura, but when it comes to what Holly was saying there about the way literature done well, it sort of, for her, pointed beyond itself, had this sense of something bigger. That's there. Now, you're not, you said, you, as an atheist, you don't deny that literature has this expansive quality and so on. But you obviously fall short of sort of feeling like you have to go to any kind of supernatural level in terms of the way that you, those feelings, those emotions that it engenders within you, that they don't point to anything presumably beyond just what you can be explained in natural terms.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I would describe myself as more of an agnostic than an atheist, because there's a level of sort of certainty about atheism that I'm not that comfortable with. But I would say I'm kind of close to it. But I think that I do agree with Holly. Perhaps I put it wrong, but I think that Lewis had this sort of hungering after transcendence and a hungering after some sort of understanding of the desire for transcendence and transcendence itself, and that I think what happened was that he came to terms with the idea that religion answered that for him. I just has never done that for me, and so it just doesn't feel like it's pointing in that particular direction, but I can understand how that's difficult for people whose desire of that kind of satisfied by religion to understand. It's just it just doesn't really work for me.
Well, I'm interested actually in the way that you talk about Lewis's desire for transcendence was satisfied by religion, and I would push back a little bit there, because I think religion is far too generic a term, because religion is a kind of category term for various ways that we understand, you know, is there a supernatural level to life? Is there transcendence? What does it look like? And the Christian worldview is a religion, but I think what's distinctive about Lewis's journey and indeed about mine, I did not become religious. I became first a theist, which was sort of a non-religious view of a philosophical view of God. There is a first cause. And then I became a Christian, as Lewis did. And I think I would kind of set that against, in contrast to, you know, accepting religion, because it's not religion broadly speaking, it's the specifically Christian understanding of the world, which is that there is a creator who has who is himself Trinity, and who, you know, has made the world and it's good, and there's fallenness in man, however we understand that, and that there is actions in history that provide an explanation for how God has resolved this brokenness. And I think that's a very, very specific set of philosophical and historical claims that, if they're true, are quite distinctly different from other religious claims, or more loosely, sort of, you know, spiritual claims about the world. And so I think that's something that's worth thinking about, is the specificity of it. I don't think it's about embracing religion. It's sort of like talking about, I'm hungry, I don't eat food. I have, you know, I have a piece of toast.
What does the idea of, I mean, I don't know how you react in general to Holly's journey and Lewis's journey, but for you, Laura, this idea of God sort of being overlaid on reality and indeed then informing the way you react to literature, to the way you read, is that for you an alien idea? Does that sound like it would ruin your reading experience if suddenly God were there, sort of an imposition upon the way you then had to view the world and view all the different kinds of literature that come across your path?
I don't think so. If I believed in God, it would probably be an important part of my experience of literature. I think that one of the things that Lewis wrote about in his literary criticism, which is now probably my favorite of the types of writing that he engaged in after Narnia, of course, was the degree to which, you know, any particular work of literature is like it's a different experience for every person who reads it, and the experience of reading is creative, and people bring every reader brings a different self to the work, and the reading experience is a collaboration with the author. I think in his book about Milton, he describes Milton as a musician, but the reader as the instrument. And so, of course, you can't have a great reading without a great instrument as well as a great player. And so so I think that would just be one of the ways that I would experience, any kind of encounter with art.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because then I remember in your book, you noted the interesting way that many different people responded to Narnia the way you did. I did. Neil Gaiman did. Francis Spufford did. And I think it's interesting because it suggests, and I would argue that it suggests that what allows for this commonality of experience, not a universality of experience, because I think what we bring to the text actually matters a great deal, but the fact that there's this responsiveness to me suggests that there's something true about what he writes. What he has written is in some way true to the reality of the world that we live in. And I think because he's writing about Narnia, which is clearly not a quote-unquote realistic story, that truth, whatever it might be, has to be on some level that's not purely representational.
Yeah, but that is true of the Odyssey, for example. I think part of the effectiveness of Narnia is that it's so deeply rooted in Western culture, and that every person who grows up in Western culture experiences, I'm trying to think of the right word, a whole sort of symphony of motifs and symbols and meanings and ideas that he, because of his incredible command of the literature, is able to, I would almost feel, unconsciously invoke, and ideas of meaning or of morality or of character or of story that he just had almost just completely absorbed into his self and was able to sort of express in this fluid way. I know a lot of novelists, and in my experience, the best storytellers among them are people who feel when they're writing as if they're just, that it's just sort of coming to them or flowing out of them, and that those are the most successful stories that they tell when they're writing experiences like that, as opposed to merely intellectual or deliberate. And I think many of them talk about how the experience of reading a lot and sort of incorporating and digesting that enables them to have that sort of, it feels almost like instinctual storytelling ability.
Well, I think that certainly Lewis was a tremendous, tremendous reader, but I don't think that the drawing of cultural elements into the Narnia books resolves the problem of reception. Because I think for, say, a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old or, you know, a 12-year-old reading, that age at which the Chronicles are so magical, I'm slightly skeptical of the extent to which especially in, you know, modern educational system. I'm a little skeptical as to the extent to which Western culture is what's being responded to. What I would suggest is actually that Lewis is indeed, I think, drawing on the various images, the planetary images, the overall feel to construct his stories. But I don't think it's dependent on that Western culture for its effect. I mean, Laura, you noted in your book that you encountered fauns, for instance, for the first time, if I understand correctly, in Narnia, and you were delighted by them, delighted by the talking animals, and then went on later to find, you know, sort of their originals in you know, Greek myth and things like that. It's actually somewhat similar to my own experience. Now, I would suggest that if Lewis's stories, like Tolkien's, I think they resonate without needing to make the connection. You don't have to know where these connections come from. You don't have to have ever read Beowulf to think that The Hobbit's just a, you know, tremendously good story. When you know it actually has an element from Beowulf, it's just much more awesome. But I think, again, it points to a kind of transcendence there.
I'm not actually, obviously when I was 7 years old, I had not read anything about classical mythology or any of those things, but I still was completely saturated by Western culture because that's the culture that I grew up in. I'm not talking about a deliberate or overt citing of symbols. I'm talking about ways of thinking that are embedded in our language and the way that we interact with the world and with the stories that you hear as a child, before you're able to read yourself. These are all part of Western culture that has certain kind of structures and motifs. Psychologists have found that it's even in the language, so that people who grow up speaking Eastern languages often have a completely or a significantly different way of looking at the world and the role of human beings in the world. It's almost on a structural level of grammar and the way the language works. I'm just hesitating to get into something like Carl Jung and his theory of the archetypes because I think that Lewis made a kind of a clever remark about Jungianism where he said, surely a description of water shouldn't itself be wet. And I think that's kind of a problem because it's difficult to trace the origins of these things. And you can decide that the origin is a kind of a supernatural, divine thing, or you can say, well, that explanation doesn't really satisfy me, and I think it might be something else, even if you don't know what that other thing is.
Let's just change tack a bit, because we've already talked about Tolkien, both his friendship with Lewis, and the fact that you've kind of lumped him in as similarly a fantasy author and so on, but I mean, it's well known that he was one of Lewis's biggest critics at the time that he wrote the Narnia stories. Look, Tolkien didn't like them all that much. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, Holly, but he, as I understand it from what I've read, felt that they were, a bit of a jumble of mythologies. Now, later scholarship may have put some of those pieces together for us. But I think he also, it's fair to say that if you read Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit and so on, there's not nearly as obvious a sort of, you know, this subtext of Christianity. Now, certainly, I'm sure his Christian worldview informed the way he wrote, but you don't get nearly the same symbolism that is sort of staring at you once you see it. in the Narnia stories, do you, from Tolkien?
Well, I actually wanted to jump in about his view of Narnia. I think that's been really overplayed because Tolkien only read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, didn't read any of the others.
Okay.
And he didn't care for it, but Tolkien himself was the first to say straight up that he had extraordinarily limited tastes. He liked almost nothing other than medieval literature. No, and he was very straightforward about it. So the fact that he didn't care for the way that Lewis wrote Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe says really almost nothing, except that Tolkien had very limited taste, and he didn't bother to read any of the rest of them. So I as much as I admire Tolkien, and he's a brilliant literary critic, I think we should actually take his word for it and say he really just didn't, it wasn't to his taste.
Yeah. But what about as I understand it as well, Tolkien wasn't perhaps totally on the same page as Lewis when it comes to inserting a slightly more obvious sort of Christian undertones, second level of meaning. Because you don't seem to see that, obviously, quite as much in Lord of the Rings.
Well, actually, that's where I would argue with you a little bit, because
argue away.
Because Tolkien himself described the Lord of the Rings as a profoundly religious and Catholic work. He described it that way, and it is as the Lord of the Rings is quite likely the most important book in my life. I've probably read it 8 or 9 times. I just finished reading it for like the 9th time this summer. And I see what he is doing, something different from what Lewis is doing in the Narnia books. They're engaging in different modes. And I think part of that might be that Lewis, in his interest in medieval literature, is actually a little later. With his look at the medieval allegories is actually a bit later. Tolkien's very Anglo-Saxon. So what Tolkien has done is he's built an entirely self-contained secondary world, has no direct connection to what he would call the primary world, the way that Lewis, following kind of in the footsteps of many of the earlier children's stories, has the Pevensies come in from our world into Narnia. Time-honored usage. Tolkien takes a different route, and he builds an entirely self-contained world, much like, say, William Morris did, like the epics. And within that world, then, there's no direct point of comparison to say this is a symbol, but it's shot through and through with Christ figures. Frodo's a Christ figure. Gandalf is a Christ figure. Aragorn is a Christ figure. That came out very, very strongly for me in my latest reading, that he is really seeing the figure of Aragorn in many ways was preparatory for me in seeing Christ as depicted in the book of Revelation as the conquering, as the king, not just gentle Jesus, meek and mild, but wait, this is also the king of the universe. So I think there is this deep Christian sense in those books, but it's a little bit further down.
Yeah, and I was going to say, for you, I don't know, I can't recall now from the book whether you mentioned much of Tolkien's own work, Laura, but have you engaged kind of the Christian aspect of Tolkien's literature in the same way that you have Lewis?
I don't engage that much with the specifically Christian aspect of Lewis's literature. In fact, I wanted to write a book that was mostly about all of the other things. And so I do discuss Tolkien, but I discuss what his objections to Narnia were. And Holly is right. We actually don't even have that much of Lewis talking about Narnia. I don't think that he took it that seriously in comparison to his writing for adults, which was kind of the value system that people had back then.
Oh, I would so completely disagree with that, but we'll let that go.
he did not discuss it that much compared to how he discussed his other work. And Tolkien barely discussed Narnia at all. So we have these sort of fleeting remarks that were made or secondhand reports of things that Tolkien said about Narnia. And then we have both of their accounts and some biographers' accounts of their relationship. So, you sort of have to guess about it. I think Holly's right when she talks about Tolkien had a certain obsession with forms of cultural purity, and particularly about Anglo-Saxon culture. And he resented the Norman conquest and the introduction of all of these French elements into English culture. And that's one of the reasons why he was so ambivalent about any kind of medieval romance, because they're so strongly influenced by French and Norman language. I mean, he would have really pointed to the language as shaping the culture in a profound way. And he didn't like it. He didn't like the French language. He resented that the kind of, it's kind of a mixture, you know. Medieval romance is a bit of a melting pot of Arab and Western European cultures, and Narnia itself is that, you know. It's a mixture of elements from all different kinds of cultural traditions in a fusion that I think probably felt really medieval to Lewis, and that felt sort of adulterated to Tolkien.
You know, it's interesting. Tolkien was very much an Anglo-Saxon writer. I'm a bit of a medievalist myself, so I'm kind of with Tolkien on this. but it's interesting. Just recently, about a week ago, there was published his alliterative fragments of his alliterative poem, "The Fall of Arthur," and it's very interesting that in that unfinished poem, he actually brings in elements from the later French medieval tradition of Arthur. There's Lancelot in that poem, and treated actually in a fairly complex way. So I think in some ways we can't pigeonhole Tolkien quite so easily in that sense. I found that fascinating.
I felt like the fact that he was unable to really finish that testified to his ambivalence about that. I mean, he was clearly drawn to certain elements of the Arthurian tradition, but I don't think that he ever really was able to get past those reservations.
Well, actually, I would say that Tolkien was almost incapable of finishing anything. I mean, he almost didn't finish The Lord of the Rings. It took him, 15 years? And he never finished The Silmarillion, which was the absolute jewel of his entire life. I just think he was incapable of finishing anything.
Indeed, I think, as I understood it, Lewis had quite an impact on making him get Lord of the Rings out to him, sort of thing, in the end. But we're talking about literature, Christianity, atheism, and everything in between, really, today on the show, as we am joined by my guests Holly Ordway and Laura Miller. If you'd be interested in getting in touch as well and perhaps leaving your thoughts, I don't wonder what impact Lewis's writings have had on you, whether you are an atheist, it's the same shoes as Laura here, perhaps in the same shoes as Holly, having had a conversion as an adult. Perhaps you've always been told by your parents the cat was let out of the bag early, as it were, when it comes to Lewis's writings and Narnia. But be interested to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. You can get in touch, as ever, online as well, via the Twitter and Facebook accounts. All the links from the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Going to take a break, and we'll be back for the last 10 minutes or so of the programme, finishing up this conversation between my guests today on the programme, Holly Ordway and Laura Miller.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So what do we make about literature that attempts to point people towards Christianity? That's sort of where we started on in the programme today. My guests are Holly Ordway and Laura Miller. Holly, as I've mentioned already, a poet, a Christian apologist, and a story herself of being converted from atheism to Christianity, with literature very much an important part of that process. Laura Miller is an atheist and has written about her reaction to C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia after she discovered, having enjoyed them as a child, that they were in fact sort of Christian allegories of one sort or another. We've branched off into talking as well in that context about when literature is done well, as it were, it can be enjoyed for what it is. You know, and the best type of literature is not the type that you feel is preaching at you, whether it be an atheistic sort of mantra or a Christian one or whatever. I mean, when it comes to the way that you've engaged, obviously, with a variety of authors, Holly, in your career, presumably it's not just those sort of Christian background type authors like Tolkien and Lewis who have spoken to you and connected with you in a deep way through their literature. I'm sure people from a wide variety of backgrounds have done that in some way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I think is a fairly serious mistake that a lot of Christians make is to think that there has to be a Christian intention, overt or you know, subtle in a work for it to be valuable or for it to speak truth. And that's complete nonsense. Just complete rubbish.
And something C.S. Lewis would have disagreed with strongly himself.
Yeah. So, I mean, so for instance, all of the literature, so for instance, Laura, you know, mentioned the Odyssey, you know, there's so much truth about, you know, the human experience as a journey, the need for a father, the need to prove oneself. This is all speaking truth about the human condition. And then thinking about my own experiences with literature, one writer that actually was, in a strange way, kind of influential for me was the American atheist horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. Now, he's not a great writer, definitely not a great writer, but he actually he's very good at evoking this kind of creepy, decaying New England town. This is where I grew up. I'm from New England, with strange monsters and things, and. Lovecraft was a through and through atheist, hardline, very vehement, and yet what he was writing about, as he wrote, he actually writes about a cosmos that has an element of transcendence, and I think he's so good in part because he's so honest. He's really trying to talk about the experience of living in the world. And I think human beings discover that there is some form of transcendence, however you end up kind of figuring it out. And he actually argues in his stories that if we actually understood what was behind everything, we'd go mad because it's so horrible. but I think that sense of a vision of there being meaning, even if the meaning is horrible, that this sense that there is meaning is a true statement.
And it's interesting because I did have Francis Spufford and Philip Pullman on this show last year talking about literature and writing and so on. And it was interesting to hear Pullman, as an atheist writer, still not wanting to sort of, as it were, group himself too strongly with the sort of the Dawkins purely naturalistic approach. He has some quite interesting ideas about this sort of matter having a kind of innate meaning that it kind of brings to itself, which doesn't really have any roots in a sort of thoroughgoing naturalistic outlook. But so he said, you know, some of my atheist friends see me as a bit of a loon on that front and whatnot. But but it's interesting that there again is someone who can evoke a lot in literature and presumably could, you know, evoke transcendent feelings in someone, even if they didn't personally hold to that kind of.
Well, actually, kind of I would argue that what makes good literature good is that the author is, insofar as he's able to, speaking truth. So I don't think the idea of evoking transcendent feelings, I think, is manipulation, and I think that's why so much Christian fiction fails.
Because if there is transcendence, it should be a secondary thing, in the sense of.
If there is transcendence, then if you try to write truly, it will come across the same way that it is true that human beings have relationships with each other. And so if you write realistically about human experience, it will include relationships. I think first and foremost, any writer needs to be honest and truth-telling. And if they are, then what they write will tell us something true about the world, incomplete perhaps, but true.
It's just been interested in your thoughts on that, Laura.
Well, I agree with Holly. I think that the best writers are expressing themselves and their experience of the world in their work. I think where, you know, the kind of alienating sort of didactic writing that we've been talking about as the negative example is really views any form of literature as the means to an end. And I think that goes for readers as well as writers. If you think that, you know, you're reading this story because it's going to instruct you, or you know, if you see it as something that you're doing in order to get to an end, as opposed to for the experience itself, then you are having kind of a degraded experience of the literature. And you know, all different kinds of writers have all different kinds of selves and different experiences of the world and different beliefs. And if they are being truthful, as Holly put it, you're going to get a lot of that just without them even deliberately trying to do it. And literature is about the search for meaning, and that's why we read it, and that's why we write it. And even if we come up with different answers, I think we can all sort of identify with the search.
It's been great to have you both on the show today. Thank you very much for joining me. Holly, what's next for you in terms of your own journey and what you're up to, what you're writing and that kind of thing?
Well, just at present, I'm working on a second edition, actually, of my book, Not God's Type, with Ignatius. It's going to be a expanded edition that talks a little bit more about the role of imagination, which I had thought about but didn't include in the book, and also includes a chapter on my conversion to Catholicism, which is the move that I made this past year.
Okay, fascinating stuff. We look forward to that next year, I suppose, is when
yes.
That'll be coming out, and maybe we can get you back to talk about it once it's available.
Would love to.
In the meantime, I will put a link on the podcast, obviously, to where you can get a copy of the current edition, and of course to the website hieropraxis.com, if you can spell it. It's
good
a
luck.
One to visit, or hollyordway.com will also get you there too. Holly, lovely to meet you, lovely to have you on the program today. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I thought this was delightful.
And Laura, thanks so much for coming on again and sharing your experience too.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed today's classic replay from the archives. Do get in touch with any thoughts you have on today's discussion. And don't forget, by registering over at our website, premierunbelievable.com, you'll get full access to all of the online material on the website and things like a link to ask a question of our Ask NT Write Anything podcast and loads of bonus content as well. Thanks for being with us. For now, see you next time.